Now, here comes another hour of great music. The Live Lounge with Dale Bartleson.
With Y01 Radio from the Live Lounge, and I am here with the fantastic, the legendary Dave Cairns. Thank you very much for joining me.
Good evening, Dale.
Now, Dave, you have been in the music industry for 40 years, is that about right? Longer?
Longer, no. let me have a think. 47. I signed with my new wave band, New Hearts, to CBS Records in 1978.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
That's fantastic. I mean, obviously, you're most famous for, you know, Secret Affair, which were massive, had some big, big hits. But I do want to go back to the beginning. A little bird tells me that you were inspired to go into music when you met John Peel. Is that right?
I wouldn't say that was true, but I can tell you that when I was at college, I used to go to Walthamstow to what used to be the Northeast London Polytechnic, and in their main hall they had monthly shows of all the big 70s acts that were on the circuit.
Yeah.
And John Peel was the resident DJ, and I went up to him at the back of the hall and said, what would you recommend that I should, you know, a new album that I should go and buy? And he recommended Lynyrd Skynyrd,
yeah,
the first album by Lynyrd Skynyrd, which I went and bought it, and it was the first Southern Boogie kind of recordings I'd ever heard. And it is a magnificent album because every song is kind of a hit and it's unusual, but they became really a bit of a cliche.
Yeah.
Over the years. And of course their big hit off the album was Freebird, which was absurdly long, but it didn't inspire me to play in a band. I was already playing in my own band at college.
Okay. So was it 1976 you met John Peel?
I think it would have been, actually.
Yeah. And then in 1978, you had a record deal. I mean, that's really quick. How did you sort of break into the industry so quickly?
Well, and by the way, we eventually ended up on the John Peel show.
Right. Wow.
and we did several sessions down at Maida Vale BBC Studios.
Fantastic.
And he kind of playlisted our first single, Time for Action, which was very unusual.
Yeah.
But going back to the band, we had a college band. We called it New Hearts in the end.
Yeah.
And we had already gone out. I was with Ian Page at this point at the same college in Loughton in Essex. And we'd gone out and seen the Jam playing a pub gig in Hammersmith, where they had very much a big punk following, if you like, as they were breaking. And all the other bands at the time, the Clash, the Stranglers. And we kind of looked at it and thought, oh, well, as power pop was sort of more melodic, better played music was being described as post-punk new wave.
Yeah.
So we very much put together an urgent kind of post-punk band, but very melodic.
And so did you sort of make a conscious...
Did
you make a conscious decision then to target that type of music because of what was popular around the area at the time?
No, it's just who we were.
Right.
And I had written... the thing was that somehow we managed to get several shows as support slots in London, and you might just do it by, for instance, walking up to two guys in the Stranglers at the Marquee Bar wearing what we had. We decided to be colourful, not black with safety pins, you know, that ripped up clothes. And we had these ridiculous bum freezer jackets, very kind of moddy, but they were made out of deck chair material.
Right,
real deck chair material by Carnaby Street. There's a guy there called Colin Wilde made all the outfits for the 70s bands. And I walked up to, I think it was Jean-Jacques Burnell from the Stranglers, and I said, I'm in a band. He said, I think I can guess that you guys are in a band. I said, well, we're looking for support slots. And he said to me, anybody walking down the street looking like you deserves a support slot.
Nice.
He said, here's our management number. And a couple of weeks later, we were supporting the Stranglers. And that's how you might go about it. But interestingly, the chairman and CEO of CBS Records was a guy called Morris Oberstein, otherwise known as Obi, who probably he would have been very instrumental in signing the Clash.
Yeah.
And he came to 8 of our shows on the trot.
Wow.
And we were then offered this major deal with CBS, but it was the wrong thing to do because when we were handed down to the people below, they didn't know what to do with us and they took us in a terribly wrong direction.
Yeah.
And when that went wrong, even though we did a full support tour to the Jam, which is interesting, and a lot of other stuff, we decided we had to get it right, and getting it right was Secret Affair.
So is that why you sort of changed the name? Because just to basically get away from that sort of wrong direction you'd taken and maybe any bad sort of press and stuff like that that had attracted?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We had a lot of bad press because the music press were all powerful and they were very snobby about who would be credible and who wasn't.
Right.
And they were obsessed with people jumping on the bandwagon, so to speak, and selling out. And the fact we signed it to a major record label, apparently it was okay for the Clash, but when we signed to CBS, they're selling out before they've even started.
That so hasn't changed now. It's still the same.
But the whole point was that when our deal came to an end, we were kept on as songwriters by CBS, and we had full access to CBS recording studios, a whole complex of studios in Whitfield Street in Fitzrovia in London. And we actually put the whole Seek the Fear album together, more or less, demoing at very high quality level in CBS studios, which was ignored by CBS studios at CBS Records, who were only two squares away. But we got all this experience and we had all those tapes with us.
Yeah.
And cut long story short, we had to get away from CBS, or they were going to destroy Secret Affair, Clueless again, because their real experience at the time was dealing with Blue Oyster Cult or some poppy boy bands, and they were all wrong.
Yeah.
So we got away from them. But the album we took literally demo-wise out of CBS studios and into Arista Records, who were a brand new team of people. And we were on Top of the Pops within several weeks because we'd already gone in, thanks to our publisher, Brian Morrison, who managed Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
And we delivered Time for Action and the B-side. So they didn't have to... We were producing, Ian Page was producing Secret Affair.
Yeah.
We didn't have to look for a producer and go through the whole shenanigans of months of discussion.
Yeah.
We delivered it and it became a big hit. And one of the first people to champion it was John Peel. We'll be right back.
I'm just another glory boy, so scared of getting old.
Did you have any problems then? Because obviously you were with CBS at the time. You were recording, you know, under their umbrella to a degree. You were employed as songwriters by them. Did they sort of have any claim to the demos you produced, the rest? Did you have to smuggle them out? How did it work?
Well, that wasn't an issue about us because we obviously re-recorded everything.
Yeah.
But the issue was we were still signed to CBS.
Wow.
And it took our publisher, Brian Morrison, who was very, very powerful mover and shaker at the time. He signed us for publishing and management, and he just got on the phone and said, look, you owe me a favor. Don't get in my way. I want these guys released. And we were released within 48 hours.
Wow. So, I mean, most people, you know, don't ever get signed to a record deal. You know, 90% who want to never will. So you got sort of two bites of the cherry, really, very quickly, which, you know, is almost unheard of to a degree. Was it the quality of that demo that got you so quickly and easily back into the record deal situation?
Well, actually, one of the key areas with this is having a really good booking agency.
Yeah.
And we, our agents behind New Hearts were also the agents for The Jam, The Cure, anybody credible, they were representing them.
Mm.
So when New Hearts came to an end and we did all this demoing of The Secret Affair, the concept behind it all, they kept feeding us as we put a new band together, as Ian Page and I as founder members,
yeah,
we already had credible support slots within weeks of getting together with the bass player and the drummer.
Yeah.
We were supporting The Cure in wow. London, and we were supporting The Pretenders. So we didn't have to go knocking on doors because we kept the agent. And the yeah. agent, Martin Hopewell, he actually said, look, I can only get you £50 to support somebody. And, yeah. and you get in an old transit van, go up to Norfolk, play the show, turn around and drive back through the night. So yeah. he didn't charge us commission. And so we had commission-free top agency representation.
Wow.
And they, as we progressed ourselves, where we were playing the Bridge House in Canning Town and building a following up,
yeah.
before you knew it, we were selling out the Marquee Club.
Yeah.
But we were in between contracts,
wow.
which meant that when record companies found out that we were on the front page of Sounds magazine, but we were actually kind of unsigned.
Yeah.
We had people coming up to us, offering us blank checks at the Marquee Bar in Wardour Street.
Wow.
It was crazy.
Wow.
But the publisher, Brian Morrison, guided us towards Arista as a new team with a yep. lot of money and belief in breaking acts in the UK.
And in hindsight, do you feel that was the right decision?
Absolutely, because Arista was a big label in America owned by Clive Davis. And it was, I think it was very mainstream and jazzy. And he just decided he wanted the Arista label in the UK to sign great new credible acts and put a team in place. So they were absolutely gung-ho to understand what we were about. And they signed us, Haircut on 100, and Stray Cats and The Beat. So we were all in that same stable.
Yeah, fantastic. So where did the name Actual Secret Affair come from?
Do you know, you'd have to ask Ian Page, because right. we've had this question. I've always passed this question on to Ian, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Because I'll be honest, when I was looking for research for this interview and I was Googling Secret Affair, I thought, my missus is going to kill me. Yeah. Googling Secret Affair, why are you doing that?
Be careful these days.
Absolutely, absolutely. So obviously, in that sort of time when you were, you know, doing these sold out shows, supporting fantastic acts, being on Top of the Pops, what is for you the highlight of sort of that stage of your career?
Well, actually, apart from really going places and obviously ending up on Top of the Pops, which
yeah.
in those days, if you're doing a club tour, as we were then doing small clubs up and down the country,
mm-hmm.
if you're on Top of the Pops just once, your tour would sell out
yep.
because of the millions of people that watched it and relied upon it. And, you know, in those days, you're selling, I don't know, over 10,000 singles per day.
Yeah.
And so that really is a huge step. And then not long after that, we sold out the Rainbow Theatre in Finsbury Park.
Wow.
Which, as a schoolboy, maybe I was 14, I saw Ziggy Stardust there. It was one of David Bowie's only two London performances as Ziggy Stardust and yeah. the Spiders from Mars. And I was a big Bowie fan. I had all his albums at that point.
Yeah.
So I was up in the gods in those days. There were no multi-screens.
Mm.
So he was just like an ant on the stage. That's the only ticket I could afford.
Yeah.
But I was there and he never came back. He disbanded the Spiders from Mars out in America. And yeah. there I am, probably 19 years old. I sold out the Rainbow Theatre and I'm standing there at the sound check thinking, God, I can't believe, well, you can believe you're there because you're caught up in so much work. You can't stop and think, isn't this wonderful? You're too yeah. busy. And I had being gifted by the sound engineer one of the first wireless, if you like, radio packs,
yeah,
which was quite a large pack that went in your back pocket.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked via radio, so radio waves. So you had antennae that were placed up in the circle, and then you could play without having a guitar lead,
yeah,
which no one there were very few people that could afford it and had the technology. And the only danger was that you might end up in the middle of playing guitar. You might have a minicab interruption saying, yeah, need to go to Hammersmith, 10-1, 10-1, Hammersmith. Then you carry on playing guitar.
Fantastic.
I managed during one big drum break. I managed to go up the side of the fire exits, I think it was, and I appeared on the balcony to play a guitar solo. Big ego thing, of course. but I was playing to the audience who couldn't believe how I could be playing guitar but not be plugged in.
Yeah.
And I was playing really towards the spot where I stood there as a 14-year-old.
Yeah.
So that's probably a very defining moment for me.
Some man waiting in the sky. So cool you wear the black night like a suit. She's only waiting for a pickup from the likes of you.
Me, I'm on the outside and in another room. Go crying on my shoulder with a glove at noon.
Untouchable you, you wear your girlfriend like a tie. A party decoration to please the eye.
You've had too much to drink the wrong time, and I always pick the girl with the wrong star sign. And who are you to call me a fool? Tell me, what do you do that makes you so cool?
So cool with your jets and perfect pants and sunglasses worn around your heart,
so no one gets the chance to see if you're playing a part. Are you crying inside when you quietly laugh? And who are you to call me a fool? Well, tell me, what do you do that makes you so cool? That makes you so cool.
So everything was going great for you. You know, you're on top of the pops, which guaranteed sellout tours. You were playing with all these amazing bands. Then in 1982, you called it a day. What happened?
We had a separate deal with Sire Records in America.
Right.
Because we were able to do that. So you're kind of hedging your bets that you've got your worldwide label, which hopefully works, which it did.
Yeah.
But North America was kept separate so that you could have if something failed in the UK, you had a chance to launch yourself in America. And Sire Records signed us and the Undertones and some other acts because they wanted it credible UK acts. But they were known for having Madonna and Talking Heads, for instance, run by a guy called Seymour Stein, who just recently died. And we went out there and we did a 3-month tour by road. I mean, we just disappeared. It was a fantastic experience, but we were only just chipping away. And if you look at the history of a band like U2, who, by the way, U2 once supported Secret Affair.
No way.
At the Kensington, I can't remember the name of the venue, a Kensington pub.
Wow.
And I don't remember this, but they remember supporting us.
Amazing.
But U2 really didn't crack it in this country because they were signed as a big deal. And they went off to the States and got their chance. And after they did probably played the same 3 months by road, you start all over again for another 3 months and another 3 months until you build up that amazing American following who will never see you as a fad. They'll be with you to their dying day.
Yeah.
So when we came back, suddenly everything was new romantics. And so we were out of time, out of fashion, if you like.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, our record label, the team that broke us over the first two albums had all moved on to other companies. and we were just around strangers who yeah. wanted to break their new signings.
Yeah, they wanted to sort of put their mark on the industry.
Yeah, and so when we'd made a third album, and I had a bad feeling that they were never going to get behind it the way they needed to.
Yeah.
And we never got one of the third album tracks onto Top of the Pops.
Right.
And that was really kind of, unfortunately in those days, if you didn't, it kind of was an indicator that.
Yeah.
And also maybe at that point, we just had enough of each other.
Yeah.
Needed a break, and we had a big break.
So you had a 20-year break. In which time
20-year break, that's what you need sometimes.
Yeah. At which time you did some amazing things, like you went and worked for Gibson and did some great stuff. So why after 20 years in 2002 did you decide now it's time to come back?
Well, apart from other record deals that I'd worked with other people, not Ian Page, which I won't bore you with, but it led to me living in America and all kinds of things.
Yeah.
I had a 10-year career at Gibson Guitars where I became the special projects and events manager worldwide for the company. And that was a fantastic experience for me, not least because obviously I like a lot of people at the company, I was and I am a guitarist.
Absolutely.
That was a big advantage. So that was a wonderful career for me. I ended up living in Memphis, representing the company. So that was a great experience. Along the way, when I did other corporate work, there was a lot of interest again in people reviving Secret Affair and other bands with re-releases. We had an anthology on Castle Music who were fantastic at collating and putting together a band that, you know, was all forgotten, if you like.
Yeah.
And then you get the interest going where we were invited by... in 2002, a very big promoter invited us to go and play Shepherd's Bush Empire with the original lineup, and I don't recall actually agreeing to it. But before I we were sort of umming and ahhing, and next thing it was on sale.
Right. Wow.
And I couldn't believe the place was packed. I thought, my God, people haven't forgotten us. And we did some regional warm-ups. Then we did a show the next year at the Scala, which was filmed for a DVD. And all this creates more and more, you know, in renewing that interest in you.
Yeah.
But the original lineup did not wish to continue. And then 2008, Ian Page and I were asked to appear at the Isle of Wight Scooter Rally.
Wow.
And we did it for fun, and we put an 8-piece band together. I'm trying to remember, you know, the horn section, and they put us in the ice rink, and the promoter came in and said, "Congratulations, you've sold out the ice rink at 2,500.
Wow.
And I thought, God, he said, we've never had 2,500 people in here. So my immediate thought was, oh, God, I wish we printed some T-shirts. And then the invites flew in, and I thought, well, shall we do them? Well, why not do them?
Why not?
And why not? So what do I do on my weekends? A lot of my old colleagues were playing golf, which I really wasn't interested in. I thought, well, I'll go and play guitar at the weekends with Ian Page. And we've had the same drummer since 2008, and we've been to Moscow, two nights in Tokyo, and constantly around Europe.
Amazing.
We've been to places that the original Secret Affair never went.
it's a crime.